Усім привіт! Мене звати Ангеліна Карякіна, і це подкаст «Коли все має значення».
А мене звати Наталя Гуменюк. Героїнею цього випуску подкасту, з нею говорила Ліна, є американська історикиня, дослідниця історії Східної Європи і професорка інтелектуальної історії Європи Єльського університету Марсі Шор. Про що була ваша розмова?
Ти знаєш, Марсі, з когорти тих інтелектуалів, інтелектуалок, яких часто записуєш і ти, які вивчають історію в безпосередній близькості до предмету. Так, Марсі викладає інтелектуальну історію і занурена в історію, якщо можна так сказати, там Східна Європа, там по-різному можна ставитись до цього словосполучення, так, але в принципі предмети її досліджень і інтересу, і Польща, і Україна, хоча вона дуже скромна і постійно повторює, що вона не є експерткою з питань України. Але якою б не була скромною Марсі, кілька років тому вона видала прекрасну книгу про Майдан, яка називається «Українська ніч», про те, чим була ця Революція Гідності, яку роль вона посідає. Це історії тих людей, яких ми переважно знаємо. Марсі підтримує зв'язок з великою кількістю українських письменників, істориків, журналістів. Вона постійно живо цікавиться Україною. І, власне, це такий професійний і ще особистий родинний інтерес. Марсі є дружиною великого друга України, історика Тімоті Снайдера. Вони вдвох плекають не лише цей інтерес до України і до історії України, але і допомогу Україні. Вони всією родиною дуже підтримують Україну, закликають до допомоги. Вона насправді вимірюється не лише в якихось там, знаєте, промовах, текстах, які теж, до речі, дуже важливі, але і банально прагматично в сумах. Вони дійсно допомагають всім, чим можуть. І от Марсі приїхала в Україну, в Київ вперше з початку повномасштабного вторгнення. Вона до цього була у Львові, але не була в Києві. Ну так, якщо я можу поділитись трошки цією забавною історією, на той момент, коли Марсі повернеться додому, вже, напевно, батьки з обох сторін будуть знати, що вона в Україні, але вони з Тімом, коли їздили перші поїздки до України під час війни, намагалися не тривожити зайвий раз своїх батьків і не говорити їм, що вони зараз в Україні, по-різному намагаючись фільтрувати те, що вони пишуть в своїх соціальних мережах. Марсі приїхала провести інтерв'ю з українцями для своїх текстів, для своїх робіт. І взагалі вона сказала, що вона відчуває більше морального права говорити про Україну, побувавши тут, побачивши людей, подивившись їм в очі. От така вона інтелектуалка, історикиня. Їй потрібно мати моральне право говорити, побувавши тут.
Ти згадала, як Тім просив перший раз, коли приїхав після війни, каже, тільки не кажи моїй мамі, що я тут в жодному випадку. Але президент Зеленський опублікував фото, і я бачу в маминому Тіма в Фейсбуці, типу, о, Тім з Зеленським, але я хочу додати...
Так, ти знаєш, яка смішна історія? Марсі каже, я побачила, що Зеленський опублікував фото з Тімом. Ну, значить, всі вже знають, що Тім в Україні. І я написала. І тут дзвонить Тім і каже, як ти могла опублікувати, що я в Україні? Вона каже, так Зеленський вже опублікував. Він каже, так моя мама не читає Зеленського, але вона читає тебе.
Але я хочу додати про це, ну, якби, зараз, спочатку про подружжя, я просто, напевно, я не знаю, до кого я хочу звернутися. Дуже багато я знаю, що є запитів до Тіма і Марсі постійно від всіх підряд. Я, коли зараз їхала, її питаю, Марсі, як ви взагалі даєте собі раду, бо це подружжя реально поклало самих себе повністю на допомогу Україні, попри те, що вони продовжують викладати в університеті. В них є повноцінні свої роботи, книжки, крім всього. Вона каже, та тяжко. Часу взагалі немає, що двічі ми забули заплатити за світло. Просто ми не встигаємо платити за своє світло, і в нас вирубало повністю світло в будинку, тому що ми просто like don't pay my our bills. Я про це жартувала, але це я просто зрозуміла про рівень зайнятості і велику кількість людей, які просять інколи Марсі так само інколи там замінити Тіма десь. Але я хочу додати про ще її дослідження, які напряму не стосувалися України, але оця погранича, яким вона завжди займається, тому що інтелектуальна історія – це непроста історія Європи. Наприклад, там її одна з найвідоміших робіт, книжка «І край попіл», присвячувалася польським письменникам міжвоєнного періоду, які були зачаровані комуністичною ідеологією. Тобто в її фокусі, зокрема, ці люди, які десь посередині, вони в між ідеологіями, вони роблять тяжкі вибори. І оце, мені здається, найцікавіше, тому що, звісно, Марсі багато досліджує Росію, вона бувала в Москві, вона дуже добре знає і це середовище, і, звісно, зараз в тяжкій такій ролі теж оцього балансування між своїми знайомими росіянами і українцями.
Ми і про це говорили, безумовно, вона в колі славістів, так, академічних славістів, які займаються в тому числі російською культурою, літературою. Вона якраз каже про те, що це люди, які відчувають особливу свою відповідальність за те, щоб підтримати Україну зараз. Але ти знаєш, в нас трошки, можливо, неочікувано повернулась розмова в бік Ханни Аренд, і я дуже-дуже, якщо можна так сказати, відвела душу в цій розмові, тому що Марсі викладає теж Аренд. Я з нею поговорила як з людиною, так, яка професійно розбирається в цьому. Я задала їй питання про те, що Ганна Аренд для нас це такий символ і фігура інтелектуальної відваги. І я її запитала, що зараз вона вважає інтелектуальну відвагу, як вона може виглядати. І ми дуже багато про це говорили, ти знаєш, доки не дійшли до питання про стосунки Аренд з Хайдегером, її вчителем, великим другом, так, чоловіком, який теж був в її житті. Питання, власне, було ще й про те, що Хайдегер підтримав Третій Рейх, і Ханна Аренд після цього не розірвала з ним стосунки. Як це можна було би пояснити? Як це викладає Марсі? Ну, от ми з нею говорили, я кажу, ну от як? От я собі не можу уявити, що є якийсь, нехай великий друг, коханець, чоловік в моєму житті, який підтримав Росію, яка вбиває мене. От як вона так от могла? Вона каже, я теж, напевно, би не змогла простити. А вона простила, да? І про цей концепт і прощення, і з філософської точки зору, і взагалі про фігуру інтелектуальну, да, Хайдегера, про кенселінг. Ми теж встигли поговорити, дуже цікаво. І мені здається, просто небагато людей в світі, з якими можна про це так вільно поговорити.
Марсі, ти ж кажеш, що зараз на неї, умовно, є такі запитання, а давайте там не будемо викладати чогось там про умовно Достоєвського. Вона каже, та я Хайдегера викладаю. Я викладаю інтелектуальну історію. Як мені довелося обирати людей, які були поганими, то я б, напевно, половину з них не викладала. Добре, давай далі слухати. Ти біжи, я біжу, а вам раджу цікавого прослуховування.
Okay, Marcy, hi. Thank you so much for finding time to talk to me. And I'm really, really glad and happy that we're talking not on Zoom, you know, not online, but physically in Ukraine. You and your family have been doing so much, have been helping Ukraine so much over the past many, many years. And somehow you still think that it is important for you to come physically and be in Ukraine. Why is it so?
Well, it's a good question. First of all, I'm so happy to be here with you in person. I'm so happy to see you. I'm so happy to see so many of my friends in person. Before this full-scale invasion, there was, of course, COVID, and there was a long period of time of isolation when we only saw one another on screen and our lives were all on screen. And perhaps also for that reason, it feels particularly urgent to be here in person. I did feel overwhelmingly like I needed to come. What was, I'm sure, an irrational way, because of course it's difficult to get here. It involves some risk. I should first say that I'm a very cowardly person, at least physically very cowardly, and I wouldn't go to the front. I wouldn't take the kinds of physical risk that war reporters do, that you've taken. You know, this was a very calculated risk. You know, I was coming to Kiev. Like, I knew that it wasn't especially a big risk in Kiev. And I also knew that we'd live our lives always with risk. There's a non-trivial risk of being shot in New Haven, Connecticut, where I live, where there are shootings every day, where at least two of my our babysitter's cousins, you know, have been killed by street violence, where if you go to the emergency room at the Yale Hospital on a weekend night, everyone in the emergency room has been shot. So it's not like, you know, I or one generally lives in a perfectly safe bubble, but we all get habituated to the risk in our own lives. And then when you take on a different kind of risk, it seems scarier because it's an unfamiliar kind of risk that you're not habituated to. Statistically speaking, you know, it's safer in Kiev than it is in New Haven. but I really wanted to be here. In some ways, in a very selfish way. In some ways, I felt like that Kyiv was the center of the world in a certain way, that this is kind of the vanguard, you know, of where, of the, you know, in German, you would say this, of this kind of Grenzerfahrung or Grenzsituation, like this is where history is being made, right? And this is where people are doing very intense thinking and intense feeling. And so I was drawn here. So, I mean, part of it was selfish. You know, part of it was the feeling that I've been talking so much about Ukraine in the States, much more than I would ordinarily do. I'm not an expert on contemporary Ukrainian politics in any way. I'm not an expert on war in any way. I would not normally be briefing politicians and going to Capitol Hill and talking to potential donors, and I would not normally be doing this, but the situation is such that, you know, myself and, you know, my family and our colleagues are, we're the bridge, we're the cultural mediators, we're the translators in this high-stakes situation. I often feel like a charlatan talking about a war that's not my war. I relate things, you know, and I tell audiences stories that I'm hearing and text messages I've gotten from friends. But I still felt like I needed to be here and I would have a more legitimate voice, or maybe I would be more convincing. Maybe I'm just fooling myself into thinking I could be more convincing with a kind of more intimate encounter. But maybe it was also just selfish. I just felt like I needed to be here.
Anyway, we're happy to have you here, even with all the risks taken. And we're really grateful for all the work that you're doing and team are doing. You say that you want to be convincing. Convincing to whom and why? Where do you think and why do you think people are still need to be convinced?
It's a very different kind of convincing than I've ever tried to do. I mean, what I normally do and what I like to do and what I consider my profession is I talk to students about history and I try to get them to make an imaginative leap into a time and a place where they themselves were not, and to understand a different time in a different place. I never could have imagined myself in a situation where I'm actually going out, you know, day after day and pleading for support for Ukraine. I mean, I was never involved in policy. I never dreamt about being involved in policy. I never thought I really want to be in Washington. It's not my crowd. It's not what I could have imagined doing. And I can say further that there are various levels of kind of surreal irony to this. So I come from a Jewish family. My great-grandparents were pogrom victims in Ukraine, in a village not far from the Dnipro, between Kyiv and what is now Dnipro. My maternal great-grandmother, who is the only one of my great-grandparents I knew because she was alive when I was a child, her fiancé was killed in front of her, not that far from Kyiv, during pogroms in the wake of the First World War. In a certain way, I'm a beneficiary of that murder because she then married my grandfather and I otherwise wouldn't be here. But certainly, I didn't grow up in an environment in which anyone had any nostalgia about either Ukraine in particular or Eastern Europe in general. All of my great-grandparents emigrated. It was still Pale of Settlement. It was still Tsarist Empire. It wasn't independent Ukraine in any way. I grew up in that family, and I grew up in a Jewish community, you know, that was also anything German was anathema. You were ostracized for buying a German car. I mean, not that I was buying a car of any kind as a child, but, you know, anything German, that everyone had an allergy to anything German. And I was a teenage peace activist. You know, I went to Abby Hoffman's memorial service in 1989 wearing a tie-dye t-shirt and peace sign earrings. So I was also a pacifist. So the idea that now, as a middle-aged Jewish mother, I would be going to Germans and pleading with them to immediately send lethal weapons to Ukrainians. Like, I mean, needless to say, this is not a role in which I ever could have imagined myself. And I'm doing it like with a sense of despair, but also without any ambivalence. Maybe because as a historian, I understood from the first moments that there was no other way. There was no other way that Putin's regime had to be defeated. It had to be defeated decisively. It was a 1945 kind of situation. There couldn't be a negotiation. It has to be over. That you're dealing with somebody who's not going to play by any kind of rational rules, and that Ukraine has to win. You know, and that literally the fate of the world is kind of at stake. And so now I go to Washington and now I go to the Germans and I plead with them to send missiles. I didn't even know what these things were before. I was on the train down to Washington and a former grad student of mine who's a career military officer was, you know, sending me like little cheat sheets with the descriptions of the different weapons on them. And he's like, okay, Marcy, I've tried to make it as simple as I can. If it's still too complicated, call me and I'll make it more simple. This is what this does. This is what that does. This is why they need this, not that. But it's just the fact that the world has found itself in such a state and that I'm playing this role is completely bizarre. It must be bizarre for you too.
Yes, but you're still doing that job that you didn't imagine yourself doing. What does it mean that someone needs to be convinced in a very, like, you're a professor, an academic, your husband is a professor, an academic, an historian, probably he also didn't imagine himself doing what he's doing now. Getting everyone, the academia, the intellectuals, convincing the people who are taking decisions basically to save the world. What does it say about this world, you know, about the people you're trying to convince or governments you're trying to convince?
There are particular pathologies with the government, you know, with the American political system. But there's more generally the idea that the world is huge. I mean, the world is big. In some ways it's small, but in other ways it's big. There are many different countries and many different tragedies going on, and nobody can have their mind around all of them. I know that when the war in Syria was going on, you know, when the Arab Spring was going on, I knew, and it's not that I didn't care, but I didn't have my head in it. I didn't have my head in it the way my friends from graduate school who became historians of the Middle East did. You know, when, you know, something is happening in Somalia, something is happening in Latin America, you know, there's violence in Honduras. I had a student from Honduras who was experiencing horrible things. I didn't know anything about those places. So I have a sense of understanding that nobody can have their head everywhere all the time. It's natural that people are absorbed in the difficulties of their own lives. And history is the kind of field, you know, because it's an empirical field, maybe where we specialize in parts of the world. You generally specialize in a time period and a place. Lots of social scientists kind of flit around to different places, but historians specialize. So I was trained as a Slavicist. You know, so this is a part of the world I know. And so there was a sense, and this was not by no means just my sense. I mean, I felt like there was an enormous solidarity among my Slavicist colleagues that because this is a place that we happen to know, we therefore have a special responsibility to be the translators and be the cultural mediators and make that a real place. I don't expect when I talk to Americans, like, what's wrong with you? What have you been wasting your time on that you haven't been paying attention to Ukraine? Because I know that it's normal for people to be wrapped up in the many difficulties of their own lives. You know, and my job is just to try to make this place real to them because I can, and to count on colleagues from other places, you know, to make those places real. And my students came to me after October 7th, after the Hamas attacks. And I had Jewish students crying in my office and saying, yeah, Professor Shore, why haven't you come to talk to us about this? And I felt terribly guilty about it, you know, and I said that it shouldn't be me because I have thoughts about it. I have ideas about it. I followed it to some extent, but I don't read in Hebrew. I don't read in Arabic. I haven't followed it closely enough. I don't know the historical details in the same way. I can try to help arrange things with other people, but I don't have the same kind of expertise. And in many ways, I feel like my expertise in Ukraine is also horrifically limited. But I have enough that I feel like I'm one of the people who should be stepping up. But what has been really moving is I've really felt like there's been a huge sense among my Slavicist colleagues, including the people who teach Russian literature and are most attached to Pushkin and Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, that it's on us. It's our responsibility to step up and try to explain what's happening.
I completely understand that the governments and other countries and people are absorbed with their own troubles and spendings and challenges. That's all understandable. But in moments where we know that the people, the governments already know what kind of danger and challenge it is, and then comes politics into first place, for example, the situation in the U.S. right now, where we know, you know, that both parties, I mean, support to Ukraine is bipartisan and have been for decades, right, from the Republican, from the Democratic parties. But still, you know, politics come in a way and they block basically vital support to Ukraine. I don't know, I don't want to put in the words for you, but still, I as Ukrainian find it absolutely cynical, you know, that it's something, a subject of political battle in the US, which costs lives and lives and lives each day. But to you, what does it say about the way politics are done? Is it just cynical and we need just to put up with it? It's politics is cynical everywhere, always.
Well, there's an enormous amount of cynicism in American politics. There's an enormous amount of corruption. There's an enormous amount of prodajnost, which is a word we don't exactly have in English, but it's there. It's been particularly pathological, definitely since Trump in 2015, 2016. I think arguably that started with Sarah Palin back in 2008, but that's a whole other conversation. You know, the right kind of split in some sense into the old right and the new right. And the new right is really a kind of postmodern fascist version of the right under Trump. And so there are particular pathologies there. And so, yes, like you're right about the cynicism, you're right about the corruption. Should we put up with it? No, we should never put up with it. I mean, in general, I tell my students all the time that we are looking to you to save the world. You know, the fact that it's a disaster does not mean we should accept that it's a disaster. Doesn't mean we should normalize that it's a disaster. What I bang my head against the wall every day about is how do we fix it? How do you get through that? I mean, I think Trump is in Putin's pocket. How exactly, why is there compromise? Does Trump just admire Putin as a kind of clever version of himself? Is there some kind of bonding among gangster types with presidential ambitions? Is it overdetermined in a Freudian sense? Is it just a question of money that's been moved around here and there? That I don't know. But I know that for some reason he's in Putin's pocket. He certainly owes a lot about his first election to Putin, you know, and he doesn't want his people voting for this. Now, the question to me is not should we accept? Of course, we should never, I mean, we should never accept evil. As a parent, I can't bring myself to think, oh, we just accept the evil in the world. You know, I'm constantly telling my kids, like, yes, you're right, it's horrible, but we have to keep trying. We have to keep trying. Our job is to try to make the world a better place. The question is how.
You admire Hannah Arendt. You quote Hannah Arendt and you teach as well Hannah Arendt. She's one of the most profound figures of intellectual courage of her time and probably all the times. That's also my opinion. In your opinion, how does intellectual courage look like now? What is courageous to say about the way things are done in the US, where you live and you work, about the US and also about the global challenges, like Russia's danger as well? What is really intellectually courageous now to say? What would you call intellectual courage?
That's a good question. I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that being intellectually honest doesn't require the same kind of courage anymore for the reasons that Peter Pomerantsev points out, that now it's not about censoring truth. Now it's about drowning truth in just the sheer volume of information. You know, so now it's not, the problem is not that the powers that be are going after people for speaking the truth. The dissidents had this feeling that the truth would save them, that truth had this power, that if you could possibly get the truth out there, that was the kind of thing that would deconstruct the lies. Now, the problem is not so much that you can't speak the truth. The problem is that everyone is just drowning and nobody really cares anymore.
They should believe the truth.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. It's a question of belief, right?
It's a question of belief and it's a question of caring. That's our post-truth world. I mean, that for me is the interesting intellectual question about Putin's form of neo-totalitarianism is the continuity and the discontinuity, the kind of the post-truth form. You know, Arendt was still in this world, you know, where to speak the truth, to deconstruct the lie, you know, was a much more radical act. I mean, I have thought a lot about, you know, what she said when she wrote Eichmann in Jerusalem and was so viciously attacked and got death threats. And that's a book I go back to again and again and again. I was telling you earlier that Eichmann in Jerusalem is the first Arendt book I read. I was 19 years old. I was a sophomore in college. That was when I fell in love with her. She was one of my first loves and most long-lasting loves. I always go back to Arendt. There are thinkers I've gone through phases of reading very intensely and then have moved further away from, but I always go back to Arendt. Yeah, I'm teaching that book again this semester in a seminar on the war in Ukraine and the problem of evil. She's always been with me. And when she gave interviews about that book, she said, well, my choice was to write and say what I really thought or not to write. But to write differently was not a choice. You know, to write and hold back was not a choice. And in some sense, I still do, even though it sounds kind of foolish and idealistic and overly kind of too much pathos for today, but I still have this kind of old-fashioned, very East Central European idea of the role of the writer. Like, you either speak the truth and you write honestly, or you shouldn't be writing.
Talking about Hannah Arendt, I've been thinking about her friendship and relations with Martin Heidegger and the fact that she did not stop her friendship, whatever it was, with him even after he supported the Third Reich. Why do you think she kept on befriending him for such a long time, even after supporting like the most horrible regime you can imagine?
It's an extraordinary story. I've obsessed about this question for, you know, the better part of 3 decades. I've been completely fascinated by it. She forgives him, and the biggest clue, or maybe the only clue that she really gives us to that, is in the book The Human Condition, which she says in a letter to him, if things had been different, she would have liked to dedicate that book to him, that the book was a dialogue with him. And in it's chapter 5 or 6, when she's talking about natality, she talks about forgiveness as the most radical act of natality. In some ways, forgiveness as the only thing that can stop what she calls the boundlessness of human interrelatedness that causes actions to have consequences that go on literally until the end of time. It's actually, in some ways, it's a very Hegelian moment for Arendt, because she talks about how the actor is never the author of his or her own life story. It's only the historian looking back who can see what it was all about, because actions have consequences that keep going. I mean, today we would call it the butterfly effect. Because of what she calls the boundlessness of human interrelatedness, you know, and the guilt of acting and the consequences that ripple outward literally until the end of time is always with us. And the only thing that potentially breaks that is forgiveness, this radical act of forgiveness. And I've thought about that a lot, you know, how she brings herself to do it. It's not as if she were somebody who wasn't paying attention or didn't think it was that big a deal.
No, I think it's impossible. Something right. You cannot just not pay attention to.
I mean, precisely the opposite. That's the thing. Her whole life was wrapped up in trying to understand how modernity led us to totalitarianism. The origins of totalitarianism, her work on that, which she wrote with very little time to reflect, that was published in 1951, still remains the classic work on totalitarianism that we keep going back to. After Trump won the election in 2016, I canceled all my other teaching plans and syllabi, and I thought, I'm going to redo all my classes for the next semesters. Everyone is going to read Origins of Totalitarianism from the beginning to the end, the undergraduates, the graduate students. So it's not like she was somebody who wasn't focused on this. You know, the weight of it was with her every single moment, and she still forgives him.
But does he ask for forgiveness? I mean, and do you have to forgive? Does it require for someone to ask for forgiveness? Because I don't remember him asking for forgiveness.
He doesn't. I mean, it's also a question of love. But one of the stories I tell my students is when she goes back to Germany after the war and visits him. And she visits him, it's the early 1950s, together with his wife. And it seems that Elfriede is there waiting for Arendt to apologize for having had an affair with her husband. Arendt is perhaps waiting for Elfriede to apologize for being a Nazi while Arendt is a Jew. And neither one of those apologies is forthcoming. And there's an exchange of letters between Heidegger and Elfriede and Arendt in the days after that visit, which are just extraordinary, you know, and which, you know, Heidegger, it's wonderful, like everyone loves one another now. And of course, you know, Elfriede would have rejoiced in the gift of our love. It was my fault for thinking she would be narrow-minded about it. He sounds like a complete idiot there. But she writes to him, she says, you know, this visit was the confirmation of an entire life. You know, she needs to go back and see him. And she loves him. You know, and she loves him from the beginning and she loves him to the end. When she gives this address, this lecture on the occasion of his 80th birthday, it's, you know, as ever, Hannah. It's one of the great love stories of the 20th century, and it's terrifying, you know, and there's no way to make it okay, but it's also something that I feel like I'm constantly provoked to rethink again. I mean, one of the reasons also when people say, well, haven't you purged your syllabi of Dostoevsky? How do you, I mean, I teach intellectual history. And so, you know, I'm teaching authors from who were writing in all different languages from all different countries. And one of the things I say is that, well, you know, I'm a historian. I can't cancel anybody. You know, in history, you can't cancel people. History happened the way it happened. History is not just the history of people who were nice. You know, I'm a Jew who teaches Heidegger. I don't take Heidegger off the syllabus because he was a Nazi. I also don't pretend it's not a problem that he was a Nazi. I don't bracket the fact that he was a Nazi and tell my students it's irrelevant because what matters is the ideas. No, in history, life always matters. You don't get to bracket life and say it doesn't matter. Of course it matters. We're always in real life. And we always have to deal with that tension. We always have to deal with that border of the impossible. The history of Arendt and Heidegger always brings me to that place of what are the possibilities of love? What are the possibilities of evil? What are the possibilities of forgiveness? Is forgiveness possible? I don't have answers to any of those questions, but I find myself continually drawn again and again to that story.
You're quite humble about yourself, saying that you're not an expert on Ukraine. You do have a wonderful book about Ukraine, about one of the key moments in Ukrainian history, about Maidan, the Ukrainian night, with a beautiful headline, the Ukrainian night. And these are basically stories of different Ukrainian young people who were there and who made it actually happen. Are you following the lives of your characters in that book? I mean, I know lots of the people from that book. Some of them are my close friends. Over the past 10 years, their lives, as mine as well, has changed drastically. Are you following how much their life has changed? And now I know that you prepared to republish the book with a new foreword. Why you think this book is important right now at this moment in history?
First of all, it was a privilege and a pleasure to write that book. Watching the Maidan, even from afar, reminded me of everything that had drawn me to Eastern Europe as an idealistic 18-year-old who was mourning Abby Hoffman's death. The Maidan for me was this moment that was not just a political transformation, it was an existential transformation. I felt like people were changing in front of me. And something was being brought out of themselves that they didn't necessarily know they had in themselves. For me, that was, it is a sign that we human beings are capable of something better. Even if we don't demonstrate that very often, that we are capable of something better. And to a large extent, I was watching the Maidan through the eyes of my Polish friends, and in particular, my older Polish friends who had gone through Solidarność. And that, I think, was very formative. I was in a very strange situation. I was in Vienna at the time, so I was an American in Vienna. But to a certain extent, I was following it most intensely through Polish eyes, you know, and I was following the Polish coverage particularly intensely. And I saw that for people like Adam Michnik and Kostek Gebert and Alex Smoller, like people who went through solidarity, like that moment of the overcoming of the boundaries between the fathers and the sons and the workers and the intellectuals and the left and the right and the Jews and the non-Jews, they knew better than anybody else that it lasted for 20 seconds after communism fell. But they also knew that it was the miracle that most people never experienced in their lifetimes, and they never counted on living to see a second time, and they appreciated it when it happened. But there was something ecstatic, like about, there was something that, like, that manifestation that we human beings are capable of something better, even if it's never been made to last, even if it's a flicker of a second, what the German philosophers like to call the Augenblick, just that, like, blink of an eye. Like, the fact that it's possible is what gives us hope. You know, and my kids were, you know, your kids' age at the time. I mean, they were very small. And to give birth to a child is to make a leap of faith that this sad world of ours can somehow be saved, can somehow be made better. You know, and for me, the Maidan was that flicker of hope. And that's why I wrote the book. That's why I found it was, and I wanted to capture that, not the political significance of it, which I'm not a political scientist and I wasn't competent to judge, but the experience of it, what it meant for people to go through.
Let me go back to your characters. Of course, it's a story of hope, it's a story of, in some way, of transformation or formation. One of your characters is Roma Ratushny, a wonderful young man who was very young when Maidan happened. He was beaten up as a student on the night in late November 2013. Later on, he joined the army and he was killed in 2022. That story and that example of a wonderful, prominent life. I mean, I don't know how many people get to live life like Roma's and achieve so many things as he did. I knew Roma personally. That's a huge loss to myself as well. But when I think about him, it doesn't give me any hope. The moment of his death was one of the darkest places during this war. The years are still to come and we lost many people, but that was one of the first huge losses. Like if you think about this loss in the measures of nation, of country, of generation, I think every character in your book have someone who was lost during this war. Where do you find hope in this story? Where do you find light in this story? These are like the best people in our generation that we lose each day.
It's a constant struggle. Katya Mishenko wrote to me when Roman was killed. I remember where I was when I got the message. You know, and I had only met him that one time, but I remembered him extremely well. He was 16 at the time when I did that interview. And I just felt sick. No, and you feel like you're looking into an abyss. You feel like there's, you know, how is that? How are we just helplessly watching these people die? I cling to, in some ways, to every little flicker of good news. So one of the other characters in my book, who was also very young at the time, not quite as young as Roman, was Misha Martinenko, who was fighting on the Maidan. And there's a scene early in the book where it's during the sniper massacre, and he doesn't think he's going to survive. You know, he's a young man with no real physical experience. He's thin, he's bookish, you know, he doesn't look like a fighter. He's very principled, you know, and he's going to stay there. He's not going to go home. And the young woman calls him, whom he had just met recently in Lviv, you know, and fallen in love with, but didn't think he was ever going to see again. And she calls him while the shooting is going on and says goodbye. She doesn't think she'll see him again either. And Misha survived. They got married. When I came to Lviv this summer, Misha was serving in the army. And he was away, and he had seen a lot of his friends die and was posting about them. He's a very sensitive person, and I knew this was devastating for him. And Maria came to meet me at Atlas on the Rynek in Lviv with pictures, and they were ultrasound pictures, and she said that they were going to have a baby. You know, so it was moments like that that I cling to. And then when they did have a baby, maybe relatively recently, they sent me pictures from the hospital. And when I got the pictures, actually, I was just finishing this spinning class, this indoor cycling class. And my wonderful, like, 67-year-old indoor cycling teacher, Mario, who is amazing, who's from this Puerto Rican immigrant family from a tough neighborhood, and always asks me about Ukraine and always asks me how my friends are doing and always asks me what he can do. And he read my book. And so when I was coming out of that class and I got that message with the baby picture, I ran back and showed the baby picture to Mario. And he had tears in his eyes. He was so happy that they had this baby. I mean, these people he had never met, but he had read about them. And so I kind of cling to those moments. I mean, Arendt would call it natality, right? You know, she's her dialogue with Heidegger's idea that what is decisive about our lives are the fact that we're sein zum Tode, we're being towards death, we're always already moving towards our own death. And she counters that with what is decisive about the human condition is natality. It is the human capacity to begin anew, to set something new in motion. That is the miracle that saves the world. So I cling to those stories.
That's a great story. But let me go back quickly to the quote by Katya, who is also a good friend of ours, and she was featured in this podcast not long ago, just recently. We had a wonderful conversation with her. She suggests that we, you know, think about this in this war and telling the world about this war and about Russia. She says that many of my friends and many intellectuals go back in centuries explaining that, you know, Russia has been this kind of empire and leading this war for centuries now in different wars. But what she suggests to think about as a reference point is Maidan as a last European revolution, which has not found yet its place in the European history. How do you feel about this idea? And do you think that Maidan hasn't really found its proper way in the history of Europe yet?
The question of has it been sufficiently acknowledged in the kind of Hegelian Anerkennung sense is one question. And then there's the question of, is that the place we should go back to? And in some way, perhaps ironically, because I'm a historian and historians have an infinite regression tendency, like at whatever given moment you're talking about, there's something that happened earlier that was important, that was conditioning it. And so you go back again and again and again. Katya expressed what my intuition had been too, which is that what was remarkable about the Maidan was the setting of something new in motion. Even as a historian, or perhaps not even as, but perhaps because I'm a historian, maybe because I'm a historian and I've always been somewhat of a kind of bezrodny cosmopolite, I'm very skeptical about these arguments about national essence, or there's always in history both continuity and discontinuity. There are patterns and there are also exceptions. I'm not somebody who would idealize the history of any nation or any group going back, say, you know, these people have, for centuries, if not millennium, have been drinking in their, you know, human rights and freedom ethic with their mother's milk, whereas these people have tyranny in their blood. I'm very skeptical of that. But what was remarkable for me about the Maidan was it was a moment of transformation. And it was an existential moment of transformation, the possibility of setting something new in motion in a much more scientific sense. I mean, my book is all about impressionistic observations, you know, and in a somewhat kind of existentialist, phenomenological, more philosophical vein, but in a more socially scientific kind of sociological vein, Onuch and Henrik Hale and Volodymyr Kulik have done sociological research about basically how Ukrainians have changed, how civic identity has changed, how Ukrainian identity has changed, how notions of civic duty and commitment to democracy and attitudes towards corruption have changed. It's a very different kind of research than the kind of research I do. What I love about that project, that was very much a kind of group project, and Olya and Henry Hale then wrote a book called The Zelensky Effect, was that it basically says that, you know, societies can change. People can grow. You know, and that's a source of hope for everybody.
Is this for the Russian society? You're a Slavicist and lots of your colleagues are, that's their subject of research, of their work, Russian culture, Russian state. Is there anything that gives a hope that the Russian society may change? What could be that, I don't know, factor?
I ask myself that question every single day. I constantly, in despair, think there must be a way. I mean, that's a society that, I mean, in some ways, I'm much more cut off from it than I've ever been, as are all of us, because nobody goes to, not only now, you know, do I not go to Russia. The last time I was in Russia was 2016, but it's the first time in my adult life that nobody I know is going to Russia. A real curtain has come down. It's become a kind of black box. I mean, our access to what people are really thinking, so limited. But I cling to these ideas like Lena Kostuchenko, that she was visiting us at Yale, who is an extraordinary Russian journalist, who's also the victim of an assassination attempt by poisoning. You know, she said...
In Germany. I mean, she was abroad. She was not in Russia.
Where she thought she was safe, but was not. When we had a talk at Yale, and she said, well, revolution is like a stroke. You never know when you're going to get it. you try to prepare the conditions, you know, and then you just hope desperately. I mean, it seems to me that there's such a crisis of subjectivity in Russia. But really, subjectivity is a sense of being an agent, of being an actor, and not just a passive object of history. And that there's such a crisis of subjectivity there, of that feeling of powerlessness, and how, what has to happen for something to change. I mean, one of the most insightful anecdotes I heard about Russia in the years between now and the Maidan was a colleague of mine, a friend from Vienna, who's a sociologist who was raised in Soviet Kiev and has had her whole academic career really in the German-speaking world. She does sociological research in Russia, or did until recently when she couldn't go to Russia anymore. But several years ago, when she came back from doing interviews, one of the questions came to Russians was, what can be done to prevent something like Stalinism, like Stalinist terror, from happening again? And when she came back to Vienna, she said, Marcy, not only did people not have an answer, they didn't understand the question.
That's a really great idea, because I feel that Ukraine and Russia are different in this way, absolutely, because we somehow reflected on what Stalinism is, but the Russians did not. They still have, you know, monuments to Stalin. Stalin is still like a legitimate figure of their history, a father of nation. They still haven't said goodbye to him. I mean, they still live in the Stalinist frame somehow.
I think there are two things going on. I think one is, or two related things. One is the failure to look that past in the eye, you know, and account with those crimes, which has been the, you know, obsession of, you know, Sergei Lebedev, you know, who has been kind of fearless about this, you know, and that sense that you have to work through that past. You have to take responsibility. There's no other way to subjectivity. And then there's also that just that sense of powerlessness. Like when she came back to Vienna, Anna used the phrase, for them it was like Naturgewalt. It was like a violent act of nature. You can't stop a tsunami. You can't stop a rainstorm. Best case scenario, you have an umbrella in the closet, but there's nothing you can do to prevent that from happening. The existential shift that has to happen is to feel like you're a responsible agent, and in fact, you are the one, you know, who makes it possible or not possible for it to happen. And that has to happen on a collective level, which is just that is the kind of mystery of revolution. I asked a Ukrainian colleague when he was coming through New Haven last year, I'm like, what would it take? He said, 2 million people on the streets of Moscow, it's over tomorrow. I said, Vlad, how do you know it's 2 million? Is 1.9 million not enough? When is it that one additional person? And what does it take? What does it take to get enough people at the same time to come to that sense of subjectivity? That's the miracle of revolution. That's what Arendt talks about, is that lost treasure of revolution. And that was the miracle of the Maidan. You need people finding that thing in themselves they didn't know they had at the same time.
One of my vivid memories of Maidan is exactly the moment, the morning after the beating of the students, when more than 100,000 people went to the streets in Kiev. And I remember myself being in that crowd and feeling for the first time in my life being proud of that crowd, because I'm a Kievan. And as this crowd, this huge crowd of people moved through the streets were not enough for this crowd. So they were moving down from Shevchenko Park to Maidan. The boulevard was not enough for this crowd. That's how huge it was. And I remember recognizing faces in this crowd. So I felt that these are like my people, people from my district, people from my university, from my school, from the media that I used to work, people whom I know. So these are all like my people. They are on the streets and I'm part of this. It's not a crowd, it's a community. And I feel very, very much proud to be part of it for the first time in my life. And I'm there as well, but I can see surprise on their faces as well, that they didn't expect that there are so many of them. They just went out and they saw each other. So I understand to some extent what you're talking about. But at the same time, I feel that in order to make it feel possible that you can come out on the street and meet someone, is also some systematic work that is being done by other people. And I just wonder, the Russian intellectuals, the Russian writers, journalists, I don't know, scholars, who are, lots of them are now in the West, I mean, in the US, in Europe, you probably, you know many of them, you talk to many of them, how they feel their task right now, what is the subject of their work, what they should be doing, because what I feel is that they don't know what to do.
That's my sense as well. Two summers ago, after the full-scale invasion, I was visiting, you know, Ukrainian refugees and Belarusian oppositionists who had escaped and Russian oppositionists who had left. Among everybody, psychologically, it was the Russian opposition who was by far in the worst state. You know, they are, and I'm not saying that particular people I know are representative, but let's just assume for the sake of argument, I felt like they all seemed like they could go back to their rooms and slit their wrist. I mean, kind of without exaggeration. There was a feeling of, we have failed, that failure is irremediable and unforgivable. What does it mean? I mean, and some of them were older, you know, some of them, you know, had been fighting their whole lives.
And that was then. And now, you know, that Navalny was killed. I just...
Right. No, it seems even worse. And I also see that there's, like, they all had both a tremendous feeling of guilt, a tremendous feeling of responsibility, and a sense that they should not speak because to speak was to take away airspace from the Ukrainians who they should be listening to. But then if they're silent, they're complicit, you know? And so that sense of they don't know what to do and anything they do is wrong. And how are they going to work through that? Those layers of guilt, defensiveness, self-hatred, failure. I definitely was more empathetic to them than the Ukrainians are, obviously, because I'm not Ukrainian. I saw that, and I know, like, some of them, like Lena, are just so much braver than I have ever been. Like, Lena Kostuchenko is someone who has real physical courage, who has been repeatedly beaten up, thrown in Russian prison, and she goes back again and again and again, and she finds herself under shelling again and again and again. She's just kind of fearless. Like, that would never be me. I've always been terrified of going to prison. I'm terrified of separated from my children. And so I felt like I'm in no position to judge these people who have taken many more physical risk than I've ever taken. And I also saw that there, it was kind of an impossible position, like the dispersion, the country's been decapitated. You feel, if you leave, you feel like guilty because you should be starting a revolution there. If you stay, you're going to get thrown in prison. So then you feel guilty too. And you feel like, and you feel guilty for not being willing to go to prison. And there's this sense of there being impossible. Like there's a sense of everything being impossible, and how do you act? And then, of course, there's various personalities who have their disagreements with one another. And, you know, there's Navalny and there's Hodorkovsky and there's Kasparov. I mean, these are people I don't know personally. I know more the intellectuals who are not such big alpha male type personalities, who, of course, all have their own, you know, own agendas and own issues. And then the question of who has like latent, you know, imperialist feelings towards Ukraine and doesn't really understand, that's a whole other question. But no, the sense of like a sense of total despair. The best of them who felt the most sense of responsibility were just generally in a state of despair.
It feels like Ukrainians have to do all that job also for Belarus and for Russia. I mean, in a way that if we do not do our job, it's not like we're responsible not only for our lives, but also like for this huge part of the world as well. It's like we are the last frontier for Russia. And this is why it feels, you know, like a quite a heavy burden, I would say. And it's a huge challenge, not only, you know, physically, militarily, socially, economically, but also intellectually, to kind of do this job, to kind of be there and do it. I know you've spent just only like a few days in Kyiv, but still you were able to talk to some people. What is your impression about Ukrainians and the state of mind of Ukrainians at this point? It's not 2022 anymore, it's 2024, 2 years of heavy fighting. I wouldn't say on our own, you know, with Russia, we're still very much supported and we're still get support, not the whole support that we need, but still we feel the support. What are your impressions? What are the emotions? What is the state of mind of Ukrainians, your friends that you had a chance to meet over these several days?
I would first of all say that precisely the point you made, that the whole fate of the world is on the Ukrainians, especially because the Belarusian revolution did not succeed in 2020. And so now it's all on you. And there is a sense that, you know, you are the last frontier. You know, the fate of the world is being worked out here. And that was in some ways precisely what made me feel like I had to be here. Because like, this does feel like the most essential place in the world at the moment. Because it has been all on you. It's been kind of an extraordinary and terrifying thing to watch. When I talked to Belarusians who had been out on the streets in 2020, who had been incredibly brave, again, much braver than I would ever be, you know, who had been beaten, who had sat in prison, only after getting out of prison and being threatened with with arrest again, did they leave the country. One person I talked to in after the full-scale invasion said, you know, Marcy, this is the first time in my life that I felt like not only am I a victim of this dictatorial regime, but I feel guilt about it towards others, because I always felt like we were the victims of Lukashenko. This regime was tyrannical towards us, and that's why we were revolting. And now I feel guilty, because if we had won, Ukraine would not be in this position. Putin would not have been allowed to use Belarus. It would be a different world, you know. And so, and he was one of the people who fought the hardest. You know, he was one of the people who took the most risk. He was arrested multiple times. And he said, now I feel so guilty. You know, and people who I knew who were absolutely committed to nonviolence were saying, maybe we should have used violence. Now look at the situation Ukraine is in. But yeah, Ukraine is now the front line for the whole world, which is one reason I find impossible to turn away from it. My sense is, I mean, I've only been here a bit, and I've been very happy to see people in person. Although it is true that, I mean, I'm in constant touch with people, and it's not as if seeing people in person, I'm hearing a totally different story from what I hear over text messages or, you know, what I hear, you know, in some other kind of phone calls. People will keep fighting because there is no sense of a choice. And I think the one point I really tried to emphasize in the States in particular was the point that, you know, Alexandra Matvichuk kept making, and Natalia's made it as well, that for people sitting in Washington, they think, why can't you negotiate with Putin? It's just some territory. Who really cares, you know, what side of the border Bakhmut is on? Who really cares about Severodonetsk? No one's been to Severodonetsk. No one else has heard of it. You know, 1991, the borders could have been somewhere else. Like, why not just give them that land? It's a big country. You've got enough room. You know, and the point that Alexandra made in it, like a very nice quote that I now like use a lot, is that, you know, it's not about the land. It's about the people. You know, that the territories that the Russians have occupied have been such reigns of terror that nobody has a moral right to leave other people under this reign of terror. It's like, well, could there have been, you know, a peace settlement in 1945 in which just some parts of the Jewish population of Europe had been left under Nazi occupation? Like, that would not be sustainable. Like, why would that not be sustainable? It's not about land borders. It's about you can't leave people in a reign of terror. You know, and then the philosophical question becomes then, why is this reign of terror coming out? Mm-hmm. Like, why? I mean, you have these 20-year-old Russian soldiers who are torturing with electric shocks these middle-aged women who speak their language and could be their mothers. Why? Like, where does that kind of evil come from? There's no reason. There's no rational reason for them to do this. You know, but that's what these, I mean, you know better than I, that's what these zones of occupation have been. Mm-hmm. That's why it can't just be like, well, why don't we just call it a day and say we did the best we could and we changed the borders around a little bit, because it's not about the borders.
Yeah, I don't know what feelings and impressions you will be leaving Ukraine soon, but still, could you describe it with a few words?
So this is not my first trip to Ukraine since full-scale invasion. My first trip was just to the west. I was mostly just in Lviv in the summer. And I missed my flight and missed a train. And I ended up accidentally, instead of taking the Przemyśl-Lviv train across the border, I ended up walking across the Polish border because I'd missed the train. And so a nice Polish taxi driver drove me to the border. I walked through that corridor. So you go through Polish passport control, and then there's that long no man's land. And then you go through Ukrainian passport control. And then I came out the other side. That was, in some ways, like one of the most emotional moments of my life, and I'm not even Ukrainian. But when I got to the other side of the border and I realized that Ukraine was still standing, like it was still there, it was still there. And this nice guy with a car, who my friend Sophia Diak sent, was waiting for me by the duty-free shop. And that was kind of overwhelming. I really felt like it was a privilege to be able to be there, you know, and to have crossed that border on foot and to really feel what it meant to cross the border and be on the other side of the border and say, this place is still here. Like, there's these people are still fighting and they have not lost themselves. It's a remarkable thing to see. And it's not like, you know, I'm showing up and I'm going to save anybody. Like my daughter, who you know, who's now 11, I guess she was 10 at this time we were in Krakow. I took her there for the Miłosz Festival, which was actually where I met Vika Melina. We were at that festival together, and I went with Talia. She said, Mommy, you know, you and Danny keep saying that you have all this work to do because you're trying to save the world. But it seems to me that the world has still not gotten saved. So you guys must not be doing a very good job. Which is a very fair point, you know, we just keep trying, we all keep trying, lots of our friends are trying, it's all about trying. You know, it's not like I have, you know, military experience, or I'm not even a practical person. I mean, a lot of the time that I'm in Ukraine, I'm sitting and drinking coffee with people and just listening to them or talking to them or finding out how their kids are doing or listening to other stories. It's not, but I somehow felt like there's importance of being here. Of just looking people in the eye, of just like acknowledging what is happening, you know, in real time. That feels like a privilege to me. That feels like something, you know, in a world in which lots of things often seem to mean nothing, that feels like something that means something. And that's, I'm grateful for those moments when you're reminded that, you know, that things matter, that human relationships matter, that the way you live your life matters.
Thank you so much, Marcy. Thank you for your work, for your support, enormous support, actually, from all of your family, and also for your book. And I wanted just to ask you not only for our foreign audience who are following us, but also for people who are looking for books and works who can explain more Ukraine to the world, to their foreign friends, you know, that they could get the Ukrainian night and share it with the people who should know or want to know more about Ukraine. So it will be republished with a new foreword on March 26th, so very, very soon. Where can you buy it? Where can we get it?
Oh, everyone should be able to get it online on all the usual Amazon, Barnes & Nobles. It should be available. It's Yale University Press.
The Ukrainian Night by Marcy Shore. Highly recommended. Thank you so much for this conversation, for all your work and support, and safe stay in Ukraine.
Oh, thank you so much, Angelina. I'm so happy to be here.